This is the Rational Reminder Podcast, a weekly reality check on sensible investing and financial decision making from two Canadians. We're hosted by me, Benjamin Felix, and Cameron Passmore, portfolio managers at PWL Capital.
Welcome to episode 175. And this week we have a bit of a masterclass on educating your kids on all things financial. So this week's guest is Robin Tobe. And it was a great conversation.
It was a great conversation, and she comes with the perspectives of an accountant, someone who's worked in finance at quite a high level, working in derivatives marketing with Citibank. But then she did all this research to write a book on raising kids and talking about money with kids. So you take all that together and her perspectives, and plus she's raised her own kids.
Yeah.
So you take all that together and her perspectives are really good.
So her book is called The Wisest Investment, Teaching Your Kids to Be Responsible, Independent, and Money Smart for Life. It's actually the third edition of the book, which I believe she wrote over 10 years ago. So it's a Canadian bestseller. And I really enjoyed the book. There's a lot of really solid, pragmatic, takeaway type ideas in the book that I think it's an excellent framework for anyone. So she had a lot of really good commentary, a lot of good ideas. We actually brainstormed a bunch with the three of us all being parents and you having younger kids than Robin and I. It was good discussion.
Yeah, it was a fun conversation. And I agree, her book is awesome. And the way that the book is set up is that it's broken up by age of the kids. So for someone who's got older kids, you could, if you so chose, just read the chapter on how to talk to older kids about money. And then likewise for younger kids, I think there's four different age segments in the book.
Mm-hmm. So she is a CPA by training, as you mentioned. She is also a member and chair of the CPA of Canada's Women's Leadership Council. She worked at two large accounting firms, and then she was also spent a number of years in derivatives marketing at Citibank. So pretty technical position.
We plan to have Robin on in a future episode to do a talking segment with us. We had the idea of doing that during this episode, but it didn't happen. It just, we kind of all forgot about it. So we'll have her on at the end of a future episode to do the talking sense cards that we often do.
Exactly. So with that, here from her home in Toronto, her home office in Toronto, is Robin Tobe. Robin Tobe, welcome to the Rational Reminder Podcast.
Thank you, Cameron.
And congratulations on the latest edition of your book. It's terrific.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
So we'll jump right into the questions. So tell us off the top, why is teaching your kids about money, as you call it, the wisest investment?
Because if we don't, there are some serious consequences to both our kids and to us as parents. If you don't teach your kids about money, they can start to form bad habits, like living beyond their means, that become difficult to break as they get older. They can also, if you've ever struggled with money or you know people who have, you know how stressful it can be. Money source is a huge, huge source of stress for people, and it can even lead to physical and mental health issues in your life. Yeah, sadly. Another consequence is that financial literacy is really a basic life skill. And without that basic life skill, it could lead to financial struggles down the road. And then from the parents' perspective, if we don't teach our kids about money, then we may end up supporting them. They may not become financially independent, and many, many Canadians can't afford to support their adult children financially. So it's really in everyone's best interest to teach, you know, to make this investment in our kids' financial education.
We've seen some initiatives in schools in Ontario. How's Canada generally doing on financial education within the school system?
Very well, because it is actually taking place across the country in every province and territory. There are courses on financial literacy. Each province takes a slightly different approach. Sometimes the course is mandatory, sometimes it's an elective, sometimes it's integrated into the curriculum, and sometimes it's a standalone course. So in Ontario, where I live, they have just revamped the grade 9 math course to include a module on financial literacy. And the grade 10 careers course already had a section on financial literacy. So it's definitely penetrating the school system. The question then becomes, how effective are the teachers at teaching it? Are the kids absorbing it and taking it in? How well is it being taught? Parents still have such an important role to play.
Yeah, that was my next question. If schools get better at it, is that enough, or do parents still need to be focused on it?
Well, an analogy is like sex education, right? It's being taught in school. Would most parents say that that's enough? Or do they still want to have like the sex talk or multiple with their kids? Great. It's the same thing with money. And there are studies that show that kids want their parents to be good role models for making financial decisions. They want to talk about money. They want to learn about money from their parents. And when they do talk about it at home, they're more confident and optimistic about their financial futures and better prepared for the decisions they'll face. So I don't think school's enough. I think, you know, it really needs to be reinforced at home and built upon at home too.
So all three of us are parents. What are some of the challenges that we either have faced or will face in teaching kids about money?
Yeah, I think for a lot of parents, the biggest challenge is feeling like they don't have the time or the knowledge to teach their kids about money. And that is also backed up by a study that CPA Canada did. And it found that 78% of parents had tried, but 2/3 didn't feel they'd been successful. And more than half didn't even know what information they needed. So parents have those challenges. Sometimes they feel like, how can I teach this to my children if I'm not even doing this right myself? If I'm not doing a good job managing my own money, then how am I supposed to teach them? And some parents are afraid that they're going to make mistakes. So they may kind of know what they're doing or they're stumbling through, but they're afraid that they're going to make mistakes and that they're going to, you know, their kids are going to become more aware of, you know, the fact that they're not perfect. But clearly, that's not the standard. No one is perfect. And mistakes are important because you can really learn from them and do things differently.
How can a parent assess whether they're a good financial role model for their kids?
Yeah, so that's one of my three strategies for parents to teach their kids about money. And the first one is to try to be a good financial role model so that you can lead by example. And I mean, your kids are watching and listening and learning from you. So if you can model good financial behavior, then they will absorb that. And in my book, I talk about 11 healthy habits of financial management. And those are practices so that parents can get their own financial house in order. And being a good financial role model would mean knowing where you stand financially, like, you know, preparing your net worth and living with a budget and living within your means. So saving and investing, having a safety net, like an emergency fund or insurance. So those are four. I mean, it's also things like, you know, walking the talk, putting your money where your mouth is important. Acting with intention when it comes to money in terms of how you save and spend and invest. So there's just so many ways that your behavior sends messages to your kids. And it's really just becoming aware of those things.
And what if you're a parent that's not good with money? What can that person do to teach their kids?
Yeah, well, that's the, you know, the uncomfortable part where parents are like, how can I do a good job of this if I'm not doing this well myself? And I try to encourage parents that this is something that you and your kids can learn together. And it's never too late to learn how to be better with money. So I would encourage parents to, you know, start with these 11 healthy habits and try to get their own house in order first. So it's an opportunity for them to kind of reset and do things better. And then again, discuss it with their kids, maybe even be open about some of the things they feel they weren't doing well and why that's not sustainable and why it's worth trying to do things differently or make different choices, adapt different habits.
I like that a lot. You mentioned acting or spending with intention. How important do you think it is for parents to define and communicate the values of their family to their kids?
Very. And that's my second strategy for parents. So the good one was the first was being a good role model. And the second one is to communicate and use your values to help guide and prioritize financial decisions. And I find values is sometimes overlooked, or, you know, parent, you know, if you know what values are, it's the things that are most important to you that you're willing to take a stand for and that you hold dear. They're like your core, at your core of who you are. And sometimes we just don't pay attention to them and we take it for granted, but they can really help. They're almost like an invisible framework to ground financial decisions and for parents to help pass on the way they prioritize money decisions and how they set goals. So I think it's so important. And In my book, I have an exercise called the Values Validator, which is a way to tease out what your top values are. And I encourage parents to do it, partners to do it, and then you can compare and have your kids do it too and see where your values are the same, where they may be a bit different. What are the most important values that you want your kids to also have?
Yeah, that was my next question. How do you do that? Do you create the values with them? And do you have it written down somewhere that it becomes kind of a touchstone for the family?
It can be. I mean, the exercise is intended, is, you know, it's in the book, it's like an actual physical thing and you can tick it off and you could copy it and put it up somewhere where everyone could see it. I mean, you can't force someone to have the same values as you because some of that is going to be maybe hardwired into their personalities as well. But I feel like it's that nature nurture thing. I think there's values in a family, such as, let's say, education. Many families value that. And it is something that you can instill in your kids to value education because you can talk about why it's so important. And so, yeah, I think having some kind of physical structure to remind you of what your values are, but just having these conversations with your kids, like, why is that so important? And, you know, if you don't have the opportunity for a good education, what are some of the consequences? If you do, you know, what are some of the benefits? Like, just again, it's all about talking about money and having these ongoing money talks.
I've got young kids, 7, 5, 3, and 1, I guess, or 1.5
Whoa.
Or something.
It's
hard to remember the age of the last one at this point.
four.
At what age do you think it's appropriate to start teaching kids about money?
Yeah, I mean, I say around 5 because that's when most kids go to preschool and they're around other kids and they're aware of what other kids have and do, and they're just becoming like more little humans at that point. But some kids are precocious and they're really interested earlier. Like, I'm curious actually what you found with your kids. Like, do you think 5 was around the time they started expressing interest, or was it a little earlier?
And as a backdrop, you said, Ben, you're quite transparent with your kids. You mentioned on a podcast a couple months or so ago. So I'm really curious to your answer on this.
We're extremely transparent about it. My 7-year-old is at the point now where he's actually asking what we talk about on the podcast each week. So I think that's wow. Really cool. My 5-year-old just turned 5 like two weeks ago. And when he was 4, he was asking all sorts of questions. But I think it's because I would talk to the, I guess, then 6-year-old about stuff. But we talk about budgeting and buying toys and why we shouldn't buy this toy to save money for other stuff. And yes, we talk very openly about it.
Yeah, I think like you take your cue from your kid. So once they start asking questions and expressing an interest, that's an opening for you as a parent to start using these teachable moments. But I remember my son, when he was like 10, he used to ask my husband if he had a good quarter. He'd be like, "Dad, did you have a good quarter?"
That's amazing.
Because he has his own business. So it's so funny what they pick up on, and that now your son's asking, like, what topics are you covering on the podcast? So that's great. Like, build on that.
So I had a client once ask me to look into this mortgage strategy. So there's a book that I brought home. I forget the title of it, but in the title was Mortgage. So I left it on the counter and it was there for, you know, a few weeks. I didn't think much about it. Then my daughter came to me in a bit of a panic one night, petrified that we were going to lose the house. She didn't know what a mortgage was, and she would have been 18, 19 at the time. But she thought because a mortgage is somehow bad attached to a house, we're going to lose the house. So she was petrified.
Interesting.
I said, no, Anna, it's just something for work. Don't worry about it. Everything is fine. So it is amazing what they pick up on.
But did you also take that time to explain what a mortgage was? Do you remember?
For sure. Yeah. So we spent a lot of time. I wasn't nearly as transparent as Ben was, and lesson learned. But yeah, my kids have turned out to be very good savers and pretty serious about money. And they link it very much to freedom now, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. So, I just remember also that word mortgage was really scary. It just sounded so adult, grown up and serious. Like when I was growing up, I remember I didn't know what it was, but it just sounded like so much gravitas. And, you know, we just have to demystify some of these concepts with our kids.
Well, because you knew from playing Monopoly, mortgages are bad.
Yeah. Right?
So
it's true.
Other than conversationally or as it comes up, like we were just talking about, are there specific ways that strategies that parents can use to start introducing money to young kids?
Yeah. So we just talked about role modeling your values. And then we kind of touched on this idea of teachable moments. So that is really, I would say, the best way to deal with the fact that parents feel like they don't have the time or the opportunity, because these teachable moments are going to crop up. Like, you leave a book out with a scary title and your kid asks you about it. I mean, you could plant those things around the house, personal finance books, and your kids might see them and they would ask about them. But no, I mean, anytime you're transacting with money, anytime you're doing anything, or like you said, you're talking about a toy that they want, is an opportunity to have a little money lesson, and they're going to crop up naturally. And, you know, just make sure that the information that you share with a young kid is age appropriate. So you're not going to be getting into that mortgage conversation with the, you know, 5 or 7 year olds, but you can talk about what is money and how do you make change and how do you, you know, how do the coins and the bills work? And I'm going to show you guys, like, this multi-slotted piggy bank that I discovered is great because it has 4 slots for save, spend, donate, and invest. So this is like such a tangible way to talk to your kids about the choices they have once they earn money. And, you know, and a young kid's going to put coins or maybe even bills in these slots. So yeah, that pig is great. I found it on a Mastermind, but it's made by this company called Money Savvy Generation. And yeah, it's like a great tool and a great gift even.
So that's a really cool idea. It's using physical money.
Yeah.
Do you think physical money, because we don't keep a whole lot of physical
well,
money in our house.
That's the other side of it. Yeah, I know. Most parents now don't really have cash around. I do still think, and like I have my little like jar of coins, my prop. Like I still think showing little kids cash, coins and bills, especially Canadian money, because it is, it could be a lesson in not just math, but history too. Like our coins are interesting and our bills are colorful and engaging. Like we even have that vertical $10 note, like it's cool. So kids might find that interesting to look at. And actually the Canadian Mint has some resources on their website. And other people have told me that if you're ever in, I mean, you guys, you're in Ottawa, Cameron, are you as well, Ben?
Oh yeah, very close. I live just outside of Ottawa.
I don't know if you guys have done field trips there with your kids, but people tell me it's like a great place to go to like get your younger kids excited and about money. And it's because it's tangible and concrete, whereas digital concepts are a little more conceptual and harder for like a little kid to understand. So I think starting off with a piggy bank, they might still get like some cash here and there for allowance, birthdays, tooth fairy, you know, holidays. It's a good place to start with young kids, but for sure, as they get older, you're probably going to be doing more things digitally with them. And there's lots of apps now coming out to help facilitate that.
I was trying really hard not to laugh a second ago because last night I caught my 3-year-old with a quarter in her mouth. I don't even know where she got it. Like, we don't keep cash. I was like, where did you get this and what are you doing?
So maybe that's a little in the couch cushions.
maybe. So I guess three is maybe too young for physical money.
Yeah, because they put everything in their mouth at that age. Yeah, that's a good point.
I have a question. You mentioned allowance. I have a question about allowance. So growing up when I was quite young, I remember the concept of getting an allowance and my parents would miss weeks. So I ended up having effectively an accounts receivable that always felt bad trying to collect it because we didn't grow up in a household that had a lot of money around. And it ended up that my parents taught me instead of asking for money, they taught me how to like get a paper route, and I had a little worm business. And this one, I was very young, so they taught me how to go find my own funds. So I'm curious if you have a thought around allowances in general, and do they work, and is there a strategy around that?
I think what you're describing is really common. Like either parents forget to give their kids their allowance. We forgot a lot, and then it gets awkward to remind your parents to give you money, or they don't have cash on hand now because, especially since COVID, like no one's taking cash. You're mostly using debit, credit, phone. So I mean, going back to what's an allowance for, it is a really good teaching tool because it gives kids the opportunity to take some ownership and responsibility for money and make those choices of save it, spend it, share it, invest it. And then other parents want to tie it to chores. So that their kids understand what it takes to earn money. So in a lot of families, that's really important too, is to get their kids to do their chores and they're going to pay them and all that. So I think that's why allowance is such a, like it's an ongoing topic of conversation, like how best to use it. And I think that ideally, like your kids get some small amount of money regularly that they have the responsibility for making the choices and managing. And then obviously they can, if they go above and beyond in the household, you can pay them. But I think a lot of families want their kids to do their chores out of a sense of family responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Like no one's paying me to do all this stuff around the house, and there's always a lot to do.
That's what always felt weird to me, to pay to do what you should be doing.
Yeah. Like just to pull your weight and help. Cause it's not, it shouldn't be just on one parent or, you know, once they're old enough to contribute, you know, to help out, whether it's just setting the table or, you know, it's meaningful. So I think, you know, you also touched on like, once you become old enough to get even an odd job, like a paper route. What was the other thing you said, Cameron? Worm business?
I sold, my dad was an active fisherman. So I used to, to harvest and sell worms to all his buddies.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Like kids get creative and they find ways to make money. Babysitting is a classic. Cause I think obviously like when kids will find it a lot harder and they'll be more deliberate and thoughtful about their own money than they will if they're just spending your money. So whether it's an allowance, cause they're going to have some spending needs and you're giving them money anyway. So it's better to give it to them as an allowance because they will think longer and harder about how to use it. Now, if they've worked for it, I think it's even more meaningful because they know, you know, how many hours they've had to work to earn whatever it is to be able to buy whatever they want or save or invest. So, you know, I think once they become preteens and then teens, working is a really important lesson.
So that sounds like using an allowance as a teaching tool earlier on, but then if they want additional income later, then working is a sort of separate thing.
Yeah, that's how I look at it. And I think like the idea is you want to start early with all of this, you know, money education. You want to lay the foundation, and especially when they're young, you want them to be able to make mistakes and screw up and blow their money and not bail them out and all that stuff when the stakes are low. It's when they become older, you know, where the stakes become a little bit higher. Maybe they're in university and they're encountering credit cards. And that's when you can make mistakes that are a little more expensive and a little harder to dig out of. So the sooner you can start, the better.
Now, what about, so allowance as a teaching tool, working for income later on, do you think allowance should increase as kids get older?
Well, yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, the amount of money a kid will need as they get older definitely goes up because of, you know, they're more independent, they're doing things on their own, their lifestyle becomes a little more independent where they're going out with friends or participating in things, going to concerts and events. So yeah, I think their money needs go up, and it's really up to the parents to decide, like, is this going to be covered by an allowance? Do we have expectations that they will work for it? Who's paying for what? So again, a conversation needs to take place where you talk about what their budget looks like, so to speak, like a simple budget. But what are their spending needs? What are their saving needs? Are you planning at this stage for post-secondary? What does it all look like? And how's it going to be funded, essentially? Like parents, contributions, kids, how does this all look?
Yeah, it sounds like it probably ties back to the family values discussion.
Absolutely. Because, you know, what are your goals? Hopefully they're connected to your values because then they'll be more meaningful and compelling. And, you know, what are those goals cost, essentially, especially if it is university, because that's like a huge expense that takes a lot of planning in advance. So yeah, I think that for sure, it doesn't necessarily mean their allowance has to go out. It really depends who is responsible for those costs, but for sure their wants and needs will go up as they get older.
How do these money conversations change as they get older? Like, do you have rules of thumb or certain ages where you can have certain topical discussions?
Well, for sure, any information you share at any age has to be appropriate for that stage of their lives so that they take it in and it's useful. It has to be suitable to their temperament and, you know, you want it in their maturity level. So you have to know your own kid. And I'm sure, like, Ben, you have four kids. They're probably different personalities. I mean, they're young still, but Cameron, with your two, they're in their 20s. Like, I'm sure they were different, what they could absorb and take in when they were younger based on their personalities. I know with my two, it was like that. So the way I structured the book and to give parents a framework for thinking about this is I have these five pillars of money, which is not that different from the piggy bank. So first you have to earn it, and then you can choose to save, spend, share, or invest. And then I broke the stages of childhood into four different categories, which are, young kids, preteens, teens, and young adults. So within each of those four age categories, those five pillars of money, they never change. They're always the same. It's always those earn, save, spend, share, and invest. But the specific topics and examples and teaching points and family activities and discussions will be very specific to that age group and what's going on, and will get more sophisticated as your kids get older. And the whole idea is, as I said earlier, is to start early and build on it.
How do you do it, and when do you do it? Like, is it a every fourth Sunday night kind of thing? Is it a like?
It's ongoing. It's like, it, I think, again, like, use those teachable moments when something comes up to take advantage of it. Like, we never had a special sit down time. It was sort of something that was like, Ben, like, more transparent in our household. My husband also has a financial background and had his own business. So it was just not something that we shied away from. But you could just use the topics in the book could be a guideline to make sure, like, at every stage you've kind of covered the basics that a kid would need to know. Like, what would they need to know about credit cards when they're a preteen? Not as much as they would need to know as a teenager, but they might want to know what it is and how it's different from their debit card. So, and again, that will come up every time you use it. If they're out with you and you're like grocery shopping or you're going through a drive-through, there's always those opportunities. Like, another example would be your taxes. They might see you in April scrambling, or maybe you're very organized and you do it ahead of time, you know, and you can talk to them about what your taxes are. And then once they're old enough to file their own tax return, they have a little bit of a foundation. So what you might talk about when they're younger is going to be really different in that area than what you're going to talk about once they're working or they're old enough to file their own tax return. So just age-appropriate information is so important.
My kids love doing their tax returns with me as soon as they get their slips.
Why? Because they think they're getting a refund?
They just enjoy it. It's we do it online. It's very easy. And yeah, they do get a refund because they're maximizing their RSP. So yeah.
Yeah. That's great that they love doing it. Like, I also, you know, my kids come over and they bring all their slips and we do it kind of together. Like, similarly, we use online software. I don't know that they love it, but they definitely like when they get it, when they're getting money back.
Right.
I find it kind of fun, which is a little sad, but I am an accountant by training. So I don't mind at all.
We talked earlier about kids starting to work odd jobs and stuff like that. To what extent do you think parents should encourage or push even their kids to start working when they're old enough to do so?
Well, again, I think with my kids, I think it was when they started working that they really got the message about the value of a dollar. I feel like nothing really hits home the way working does. Because, you know, teenagers are not going to get the greatest jobs. Sometimes they're, my son was like a dishwasher and, you know, worked kind of kitchen jobs for a while. And those are like tough jobs. My daughter was more like in an office job kind of person. Like, she was working in the summers in at my husband's office and then in an accounting firm and stuff. So I feel like working, it's going to depend on the kid too. And some parents are worried about school. You know, how much time do you want your kid working if they don't have to, if they're not in a financially stressed situation? Maybe they're better off arguably focusing on their studies in school and extracurriculars. So it really depends. Like, I can think, like, my niece and nephew, they both taught skiing, ski racing and coaching and stuff on the weekends. So that was kind of a way to combine like what they like to do and like a sport thing with actually making pretty good money. So it really, I think it depends on your situation, but maybe once they're old enough to work in the summers and they're, you know, what else would they be doing in the summer? I don't know. Some kids go to camp, some kids take more school, but I think summer jobs are kind of the perfect time. What did you find, Cameron, with your kids?
In terms of working?
Yeah, like, did they work during their high school years or?
Yeah, my daughter worked in a restaurant since she was 14, 15. And my son had a paper route.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started working here, 4 years or so ago, Ben?
Yep.
So oh, it would have been 16, 17, when he's 17, 18, when he started with us here.
Yeah.
They didn't start as young as I did. I may have been a little too eager at a young age to start working.
I think it depends too on your family's means. Like, it's values and means though. I mean, if a parent can't afford to, you know, support their kid and pay an allowance and the kid wants to do things, then they're going to have to get some kind of money coming in, whether it is a paper route. I know my assistant said she had a paper route too from a young age. So, and you know, you do see a lot of kids babysitting or tutoring, you know, some like slightly older kids tutor younger kids. That's a good way to make some extra money. So I think every situation is going to be unique, but I feel like working is very valuable.
I agree. Personally, I worked every summer, I think since I was 12.
Yeah.
Doing like pretty hard, dirty labor, manual labor type jobs.
Really? Construction things?
Yeah. Construction. I worked in the yard of a logging company for a summer. I love it. Loved it.
Oh yeah.
You loved it, but did it make you like appreciate the value of an education where you would maybe have like a dip, like a desk job or like a job that wasn't physically demanding?
I love that I had the experience. I didn't love doing the work.
Well, that's just it. It allows you also to like eliminate things that you don't want to do in the future or to figure out what you do want to do. Like, I think anytime you're working, you're out in the real world, you're meeting people, you're networking, it's all good. So, you know, I just think some kids, it might be really hard to balance a part-time job and school and extra, depending on what it is.
I was a butcher all through high school, all through my teens. That's why I've got this side of beef in my wall and in the art of my wall. But I loved it. Loved everything about it. It was a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of dirty work, but I loved it. Loved working with clients, customers in the store. It was great.
Wow, that's an interesting one.
So next topic for you, and I was going to ask about social media impact on spending, but I think social media must have an impact on all of this. So even when we ask social media, what do you think of in relation to what your specialty is?
Okay, I think social media has, out of, let's say, the five pillars of money, I feel like it has the most impact on spending for sure. Because, you know, it's just another way for kids to feel peer pressure. And it's so much more intense because your kids can see what everyone else has and does. And it's in this perfectly curated way. And research shows that our minds automatically make upward social comparisons. So we compare ourselves with people that have more, and then we end up feeling bad about ourselves or our situation. And these studies show that kids that spend too much time on social media can lead to dissatisfaction with life, bad mood, and it can also lead to overspending. Like there was one study that they surveyed 900 Canadians. 25% of those people said that FOMO, the fear of missing out, was their main motivation to shop. And 70% thought that almost a quarter of their debt was from FOMO overspending. Yeah, that's crazy. And there's now social commerce, which is the combination of basically social media, e-commerce, and peer pressure. So you can actually buy things within these social media apps now. It's like integrated with Shopify and with Square on the payment side. So it's like there's no friction.
It's interesting with my kids. So Anna went through the spending phase, but she's through that now big time. And now it's more about experiences. So she sees people, for example, traveling. She just went on a fantastic trip to Vancouver and Whistler.
Nice.
So she's migrating more towards spending on memorable events like that. How, any ideas on how we can, and this just happened to her. I didn't coach her. It just happened. Do you have any suggestions on how we can communicate with the kids the importance of spending money on memorable events as opposed to more stuff?
Right. Because the research does show, like the happiness research shows that stuff, people become dissatisfied with their stuff very quickly because there's always better stuff, newer stuff available. Whereas things like experiences, they really stay with you. And I think the way to go about it with your kids is to ask them, like, what was the last thing that you were dying to buy? And like something significant that they would have had to save up for. So like, you know, with my son, he, you know, for him, it's probably some kind of musical equipment, like, because he's a musician. And with my daughter, she's more into fashion. So maybe a purse or something. And just ask them, like, did it really make you happy? How long did that last? Was it worth it? The time and effort, you know, that you would have had to work or the amount of money that you spent on it. And then compare that to something that you did recently. Now, it's a little tricky with COVID because we weren't able to have a lot of those experiences that make us happy, sadly. But if it was like a concert or a hockey game or a trip to, you know, Vancouver, whatever it was, and like what lingers with you longer? Like what makes you happy? What's your happy place? You know, when you think about what really, you know, lights you up, is it that thing that you bought or is it something that you did? Like, I know my answer. Like, I like nice things too, but I think in our case, like we did a lot of traveling with our kids when they were younger. And even when they were older too. And some of those experiences, we went to Iceland with our daughter one year and we did such cool activities. Like we went cold water snorkeling and we kayaked on a glacial lake and we went horseback riding on this like volcanic beach. Like, oh my God, those things. And yeah. And I really remember like a lot of things about that trip because it was so different. And just concerts. Like I remember taking my son to like Avril Lavigne was the first concert I think I took him to. And she's from your neck of the woods, Avril. And she was so big when my kids were like, I don't know, 12 and 10. And just like how important music is in our household and like how much we value going to concerts and seeing live events and stuff like that. So just like, yeah, those things really bring me happiness.
It's funny. My daughter actually went backstage at the Avril concert. I think really? That was her first concert as well. And she has that picture of her and Avril arm in arm on her wall.
How did she get backstage?
It's one of those things you pay to play.
Oh, it was like one of those meet and greets?
Yeah, one of the meet and greets, exactly.
Yeah, my son did that with Todd Rundgren, which is like his musical idol. I don't know if you know him, but anyways, he's amazing. And I met Springsteen backstage and I'm like this massive Springsteen fan. So like nothing tops that to me. Like that's the greatest thing ever. So like, I think the kids can, I think they get that. And I think they can also understand that like sometimes it feels really good to give instead of receiving. And like, you know, you can ask them like, what was it? Or talk about a thoughtful gift that they bought you. I just was talking about my daughter bought my husband one year, the scratch map of all the places that he traveled to. Like just stuff like that, like a gift that really resonates with someone that like, or the gift you gave me, these cards that are so great. It's nice to get something that's thoughtful.
I think kids do get it, but I also think you're right that it requires reflection. Like asking them that question about what was more memorable, that thing that you bought or that experience that you had or giving or whatever. I've definitely seen that with my kids. Like I give them an allowance and both of the boys really wanted to buy these dinosaur toys. So I said, okay, we went to the toy store and we bought them. And 2 weeks later, they weren't playing with them. And I asked them like, hey, you guys aren't playing with these anymore. How do you feel about the money that you spent on it? And it was definitely a good opportunity.
Wow, that's great.
Teach.
Exactly. Because I remember my kids, you know, like toys when they were little were really trendy. Like there was always something like Silly Bands, Webkinz, whatever it was. And they would always want whatever the kids at school were playing with in the playground. And then, you know, you'd be at the store and they would, you know, be like, I want. So the first thing is like, well, you have some money in your piggy bank or wherever. Do you want to use your own money for that? Or maybe you offer to split it with them. But sometimes you'll say like, oh, remember that last thing that you absolutely had to have? Like, where is that actually? Can you even find it in the house? Like, you know? So I think you're right. It does require reflection. And again, that's about being, you know, bringing more mindfulness because it's just so easy. You get caught up in all this frenzy. There's no friction around spending. And it's like, accumulating stuff. And you do have to step back and go, wait a minute, you know, is this really helping me get towards my goals that are important to me? Or am I just like kind of wasting money on silly things?
So we just touched on material purchases and social media. Cell phones kind of tie both of those things together. At what age do you think kids should be allowed to get a cell phone?
So the average age is 10. Now, wow. I was also talking about, yeah.
Jeez.
That was, you know, I researched it when I wrote the book and I was talking to my assistant about this yesterday because I know that my kids got their first flip phone cell phone. So my kids are now 24 and 26. So they were around 12, 13 and they shared it. And it was only for like when they were going out, like they were going to a lot of bar and bat mitzvahs and we would have to pick them up. There was like a carpool. So we would have to, it was for logistical reasons. And they weren't like text, none of that, you know, this is a long time ago, but now it's like, is a cell phone a need or a want? Like a lot of parents communicate with their kids that way. So the average age is 10 and they're probably smartphones because try and find a flip phone now. Not easy. And I think you have to think about like how responsible are they? Like, what are they using it for? I mean, let's say they babysit at night and you want to be able to reach them, or they take public transit to school, or there's so many reasons I think you can justify them having one. And honestly, it's so, how do they communicate with their friends and their peers and everything without one these days? But then it's like, okay, well, who's paying for it? And that's, again, a potential teachable moment. Some kids have to pay for their own cell phones right from the get-go. Like, figure out where to get it, what it's going to cost you, how you're going to use it, what kind of plan you need. You know, other people looking and their parents pay for it. So, you know, I think there are so many issues wrapped up in this, don't you think?
Absolutely.
And it links to my next question, which is, as the kids get older, how and when do you think they should be given more financial responsibility?
Well, you know, that goes back to what we were saying earlier, like how much money do they need? What does their life look like? So when they're younger, they're getting an allowance. Maybe it's a rule of thumb. But once they become preteens and teens, any money that they are bringing in, whether it's allowance or working, is kind of based on how they're living their lives, what they're doing, where they're spending it, and how they want to save. So I think they need to start taking more responsibility so that they can, you know, learn from their mistakes and build on that knowledge, like we talked about before. So whether that responsibility comes in the form of more allowance that they're getting less frequently, so they have to manage it over a longer period of time, like a month instead of weekly, whether it's in the form of a job, which we all know, especially, you know, it's not, if it's working for, you know, like not in your family business, but externally, you know, you have a boss, you have someone you're reporting to, all that stuff. Like, that's really teaches them to be responsible. So yeah, I think it's such a good opportunity at that stage. Teenagers, I think that's a critical time. I really do. I mean, you're not there yet, Ben, but I think Cameron, you know what I mean. Because then they're going, you know, then once they finish high school, they're either working or they're continuing their education. So that point, you want them to have some experience with money, and you don't want them going off to university, let's say, and they're on their own for the first time and they've really never managed money. And all of a sudden they're renting an apartment and they're shopping for food and they're paying for the tuition. And, you know, you want them to have some grounding in this.
How do you think parents should coach teenage kids to set financial goals?
Back to the values conversation. So if you have a chance to do that exercise, you understand what's most important to you, then you can tie your goals back to your values. So whether it's paying for school, traveling, maybe some kids still want to get a car, I don't know anymore. But I think, you know, when teenagers are living at home, if they are working, it's really mostly to fund their spending, but maybe they're saving hopefully a little bit. But once they get a bit older, I think it's you know, the stakes become higher. You know, it becomes a little more serious and a little more real.
At what age do you think you can actually start talking about investments with kids?
Yeah, so it depends what you mean by investments. Like, if we're talking about managing a portfolio and like securities, I think that probably the earliest would be high school. And, you know, there's courses in school that get into investing and clubs and university age, like in the 20s. But even younger, I think you can get into stuff like interest. Like, just even once they open their first bank account, when they grow their piggy bank and they open a youth account, that, you know, the bank pays you interest, maybe not very much, but when you have your money in a bank, they pay you interest. If you have to, borrow money, then you have to pay interest. You can talk about compound interest once they get a little older, because they might be learning that in school, hopefully. That's a great way to tie math and financial literacy together. So the power of compound interest and how it really helps your money grow. Because they can, even young kids, once they've accumulated some money, they might have enough to open a term deposit or a guaranteed investment certificate. And you can talk about locking in your money and getting a little more interest and all that stuff. So I think there's, and I don't know, I mean, a lot of kids these days are really interested in stocks because of the meme stocks. And my son, who's 26, told me yesterday that he knows someone from high school that just made like $5 million on a NFT, on a non-fungible token. And he showed me, like, it was like that monkey thing, you know, that I'm sure you've seen, that pixelated monkey. And it was like really, like, you actually know someone, like, you think these are urban myths, but like, so I think some kids are going to be super interested in that kind of stuff, cryptocurrencies, all the latest stuff like that. So really, again, take your cue from your kids. Like, what are they asking you about? What are they showing an interest in?
Now there's some research that's been done so far on the investing apps, like on Robinhood, or we have Wealthsimple Trade in Canada. And what we're learning from that research is that the apps are designed to basically encourage what most people would say is pretty bad behavior from an investing perspective. Do you think kids need additional guidance on that?
Yes. And I know in Canada, I think the rules are different here in Canada versus the US. I don't think a minor is able to open an investment account here. And I know that what I did when my kids were younger was I had a discount brokerage account open for them in trust. Like, it was me in trust for each of them because they had gotten some money for their bar and bat mitzvahs, like when they turned 13, and I wanted to invest it for them. So in Canada, like, there's different regulations, but I think still there are parents who are opening an account, like a trading account, and they're doing it with their kids because that's legally the only way they can open the account, but maybe it's their kids' money in there. And they're involved. So I think I think parents do need to be around and guiding, because it's really easy to get carried away. And these apps and tools are designed to get you, like, they're just as addictive as social media in terms of how they've gamified things. And they're intended to keep you on the platform and to give you FOMO and tell you what other people are buying and doing, and like, oh, your stock hit this or that, you know, milestone. So I would think that very few kids, teenagers, or even 20s are like equipped to do that on their own without possibly making an expensive mistake. I mean, maybe some parents don't even feel like they're comfortable supervising that type of activity if they're not, you know, used to doing that themselves. Like, yeah, this really opened up like a whole, these meme stocks during the pandemic have really opened up a whole can of worms.
No kidding.
Definitely.
Another question for you. When are kids ready to learn about philanthropy, and any advice around that?
Yeah, I love that question. I'm so glad you brought it up, because I talk about SHARE in the book. You know, it's one of the five pillars and it's in every chapter. And I think kids are ready to learn about that young, about giving back. And it doesn't have to be like fancy philanthropy. It could just be as simple as giving your old toys or your old clothes to families in need or others who are less fortunate than them. And I think it's so important to start it early, because it really helps to put things in perspective for your kids, that not everyone lives the same way that they do, and it may help them appreciate what they have and combat some of this FOMO and social media feelings of, you know, I don't have enough, I'm not good enough, by just putting things into perspective and giving back and helping others. So I think it can start really young with that. You can do things together as a family. Like, my daughter and I used to volunteer at Soup Sisters, which was an organization in Toronto where you went to like a facility and you made different recipes of soup. There was different teams, different stations. And then they would bring someone in from the charity that it was supporting. It was usually shelters for women and children. And we would do it with her friends and their moms. So like, there's ways. I know other families that have volunteered together out of the cold, which is like a soup kitchen held at synagogues and churches in Toronto. So there's so many things you could find that you could bring your kids along for. And then obviously as they get older, they can get involved in things that they're passionate about, causes, charities, or if we're talking about high net worth families, sometimes they have their own foundations and they can get involved that way. So there's so many, you know, there's, and even in schools, right? I feel like the schools do a great job with fundraising and with raising money for causes. I know my niece was involved even during COVID. They did a virtual Terry Fox fundraiser where you just had to do like activities and clock it. And so we used to go for these long hikes because it would count. And she was like on the top of the leaderboard. So there's so many great ways kids can get involved with that through school. And it's so important, like, just to broaden their perspective.
For families that work with a financial advisor, like Cameron and I are portfolio managers at a wealth management firm, we have clients. The clients often have children. Do you think there's value in parents connecting their young adult children, so when they're a bit older, with their financial advisor?
Absolutely. I think the issue becomes, like, I'm sure you've seen those ads where they're like, you're not still using mom and dad's guy, are you? Right? So there's that generational difference in how, you know, 20 somethings are managing money now, a lot more technology is involved. And, you know, there's the stats that show that like a very, very high percentage of people, when they inherit money, they either change advisors or they stay with their own. So I don't think you can force it, but I think it's a great idea to introduce the relationship and see where it goes, see if there's a connection. And it also gives like a 20 something an opportunity to meet with a real person and see what that model looks like, because it's very different than like a robo advisor or whatever they may have been using based on, you know, how much they had to invest. So yeah, I think it's a really good idea. And I think you have to just find those points of connection, like what would be, you know, a meeting that would be helpful to all parties.
So two words that my kids will tell you, I say all the time to them about money, is human capital. Mm-hmm. And how important it is to focus on human capital. Play the long game. Don't get hung up if you have a bad night at the restaurant. You don't get a lot of tips. Don't worry about it. Just keep your head down. Do good work. Keep learning and build up your human capital, because that will help you long term with your financial capital. Do you have any guidance on how to coach kids on the concept of human capital, and specifically how that might relate to further education or just their general attitude towards it?
Well, first of all, it sounds like that's like a very strongly held value for you, education or human capital. And it sounds like your kids are absorbing that, like they hear that message. I mean, Warren Buffett famously says, like, the more you learn, the more you earn. I think that there's different ways we can talk about that with our kids, which is, I mean, maybe it just starts with what you do for a living and what education you needed to have to be able to do that. And you can even, like, you know, once they're a bit older, go online and look at what different careers, like what they pay and what the degree costs. And, you know, right now, computer science, engineering, those jobs are super high demand. So you can talk about what kind of educational background those jobs require. And then, you know, another thing is, like, if you think of your own network of family and friends, I'm sure they all have different careers, different jobs. And we used to joke around, my husband and I wanted to do like a job fair of like just people we knew, like family friends, because we had so many friends. They were lawyers, doctors, dentists, like worked in investing, all kinds of interesting things. And it's just an opportunity for your kid to ask some questions about what they do and what they like about their job, maybe they don't like, where they went to university. Because it's surprising, some people, especially a lot of business owners, like they take circuitous routes to where they end up. Like, it's not always what you expect where they began. I think like some kids, like maybe at school, they're learning a little bit about, like, I don't know how effective the careers course is. My kids didn't take it that seriously, unfortunately. But I think it is if it's not taken seriously, it's a missed opportunity, because, you know, they're supposed to be teaching you some practical skills, like how to write a cover letter and do your resume. And that also gets you thinking about, okay, well, what other experience do I need? How do I start building my resume with outside things, with even with summer jobs and my network and all that stuff? Because I agree with you, like, you know, going back to what you said earlier, Ben, about doing like a manual labor job versus like a job that requires a lot of intellectual capital, like, you know, knowledge workers had a huge advantage during COVID. You can even talk about that.
Yeah, that's a great talking point for kids.
Yeah, I mean, again, depending on their age, like, I don't know that I would do that with your five-year-old, but like maybe Cameron's kids, for sure. My kids, definitely. We definitely talked about that, because my son is a musician and he was a bartender. So he was like first to lose his job. He was working at an event space in the Distillery District in Toronto. And, you know, and he's got a university degree in philosophy. But he was trying to figure out what he wanted to do, and he wanted a chance to still do his music stuff. And so, but he was, you know, it was a physical job that had to be done in person, and he was not working. Whereas my daughter, who's actually a CPA also, and she actually just passed her level one CFA today. Woohoo!
Wow.
Yay! I'm so proud of her. So she was working throughout the pandemic. She worked, she switched accounting firms, but she was able to continue doing her job like from home throughout the whole pandemic. So, you know, their degrees probably cost around the same. you know, but they went to different schools. One went to, she went to Western, he went to Queens, but the career paths that came out of those two degrees, philosophy or business, very different.
What about entrepreneurship as opposed to talking about education and human capital? Many people don't end up with higher levels of education, but start successful businesses. Yeah. How can parents talk to their kids about entrepreneurship and that path?
I know, it's almost like sometimes it's an advertisement for dropping out of school. If you look at like Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, but I'm kidding. Don't do that. We did this meetup, like a economic and financial book club meetup a couple of weeks ago. And someone brought up the idea that like brought up the point that everything he learned was kind of as a kid in his parents' business. So there was a family business. It sounded like it might have been retail. And from a really young age, he was just kind of at his parents' feet, like in that business. So I think a lot of kids are exposed to entrepreneurship that way, through some kind of family or friends that have a small business. There's so many small businesses in Canada. So that's one way kids get exposed to it. And again, like you have to ask yourself, are entrepreneurs made or born? Like are kids... Is that something that you can be taught, or is it something that is kind of hardwired where you really want to build something and start something and you don't want to work for someone else? Like it's not going to be for everyone. I think high school courses now are way better, more sophisticated than they were when I was going through high school, which is a long time ago. But my assistant who graduated from high school about 5 years ago, she in BC, she told me she took a grade 12 course where it was an entrepreneurship course. And at the end, they had to actually come up with a business idea and a business plan. And hers was about like healthy hummus, you know, that Middle Eastern dip. So, and they had to scout locations and like really get into like creating a business plan. So that's in grade 12. For sure, once you hit, I think there's now probably undergrad and for sure MBAs that just specialize in entrepreneurship. But another really cool thing is like these extracurricular programs in high school, like Junior Achievement, they have one that's just for entrepreneurship. I think the Economics Clubs of Canada has stuff that like encourages. I think there's so many startup organizations that encourage it. Like, I feel like it's such a big thing now in Canada and everywhere.
Yeah, we actually, PWL sponsored the Junior Achievement Entrepreneurship Program, and me and one of the other guys that it doesn't work here anymore, but used to work here, we both volunteered in that program. It was a very impressive program.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
In your local community?
Yep.
So how many, I'm curious, like, was it like a 4-week program or was it?
Oh, geez, this was years ago now. No, it was longer than that. It was, Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember how the time was divided up. If it was like a semester, do they even have semester?
For sure.
Was it a semester? Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure the kids got a lot of value out of that. Those are the kind of things that can stay with them.
Yeah.
What can parents who may find themselves in a household that struggles financially do to help their children avoid having money or money psychology issues in the future?
Right. So yeah, like it is that fine line, because we said earlier, you want to be transparent with your kids and you want to be honest. And when they have questions, you want to answer them as honestly as you can. However, you also don't want to worry them excessively, especially about things they have no control over and that they're not responsible for. And really, as parents, we are the ones that are responsible for managing the household and the finances. So, you know, again, you can try to be open about the mistakes that you've made and what you've learned and the changes you made that are hopefully healthier. Again, I'll emphasize that you really want to take into account your child's age and maturity, stress, confidentiality. And, you know, some kids may not have the temperament to deal with it, like if they're anxious already. But on the other hand, kids are pretty smart and they know what's going on. They watch and they listen and they hear a lot more. So I think in the end, you're better off talking to them about it. But like, it's like any parenting conversation, you have to remember like who's the parent and who's the child. And I think some things you do want to shield them from. As they get older, it's a whole different story. And I know like lots of kids have had to grow up fast because they're either financially or for some other reason, their parents just couldn't provide what they wanted to or needed to. And you know, every situation is a little bit different. So I don't know. There's no like easy answer to that one.
What about the opposite, I guess, if you can call it that, situation where a family is very affluent and maybe the family is spending a lot of money on their housing and on vacations and all that kind of stuff? Is there anything that parents in that situation can do to avoid their kids feeling entitled or not appreciating the value of money?
Yeah, I mean, that's for parents of means, wealthy parents, that's a really big concern. If you talk to wealth managers like you guys, like it, I hear that it keeps them up. It's what they're most worried about. It's not like managing the money. It's like that their kids are prepared and that they're going to grow up with a sense of purpose and not a sense of entitlement. And that is the trick, because like, if, especially if you're an entrepreneur, or you've worked hard, or even an executive, someone who makes a lot of money and they work really hard for it, and you want to enjoy the fruits of your labor. But at the same time, your kids are accustomed to this really fancy lifestyle and they don't necessarily appreciate what it costs or what it takes to earn it. So, you know, I think, and in wealthy families, kids may struggle to find a sense of purpose if like the parent or grandparent casts a shadow, and everyone needs purpose in their life. So I think to try and encourage them to find what it is that they're most passionate about and then follow that, you know, into their career, to give them that sense of purpose. Other things we talked about, like the importance of giving back and being involved in the community and helping others, because, you know, research does show that making meaningful connections and serving others can really help you have a fulfilling life. I think also with money can engender dependency, and most of us want our kids to be independent, even if there is money in the background. So I think you want to talk to your kids about the difference between needs and wants. And then, you know, really emphasize gratitude and being appreciative of what they have. Like we talked about that earlier, but just maybe making it a practice, a gratitude practice, going around the table at dinner each week and sharing like a highlight or a small win that you're grateful for, just to continue to put things into perspective, do family philanthropy projects, encourage them to work from a young age, just really help them discover what's going to give their life meaning, purpose. You know, one of the stories I've read about in the news is about Abigail Disney. So I don't know if you guys know who she is, but she is the great niece of Walt Disney. So her grandfather was Walt Disney's brother, Roy. And she talks about how when the price of Disney stock quadrupled in the 1990s, like their family went from being like comfortably upper middle class to like hugely wealthy, and they had their own 737. And for her, rather than ending up being like entitled and spoiled, she has really gone in the other direction. Like she's now an activist and she's often outspoken about Disney's employment practices. She has a podcast where she talks to like what she calls good troublemakers about changing the world. And she's also a documentary filmmaker. So even though she's extremely wealthy and grew up with that family and could have gone in a different direction, she found her purpose and is using her money. And she's also like a huge philanthropist. She gives a lot of money away. So there's also good examples of children of very wealthy families who do end up leading productive and fulfilling lives. But I think, yeah, it could easily go the other way if there's just too much money sloshing around and there's a lot of dependency on the family.
Hmm. So you're a CPA. Have had a career in accounting, I think, and also in finance. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So early in my career, I worked in accounting firms. I was in tax for a while. And then I worked at Citibank in derivatives marketing for 5 years. So that was really different too. And yeah, so now I've been doing this.
Yeah, I got to ask, how did you end up deciding to make the shift to being an author?
So it's funny because I was always good with words and with numbers. Usually it's like people are either like a numbers person or they're language person, but I was always good with both. And yeah, I've always enjoyed reading and writing. So 10 years ago, when the book first came out, it was published by CPA Canada at that time. And they were the ones who commissioned me, who asked me to write the book, because they had, done research on financial literacy and they found that parents were really struggling with it. And this was after the 2008 financial crisis. There was a lot of attention was being paid to financial literacy and maybe trying to help people have more knowledge and skills and confidence in this area. So that's how it began. They asked me to write this book. At the time, I was like, that's an interesting challenge. Like I wasn't one of these people that was dying to write a book. So, but I felt that I had the background and the experience because my kids at the time were, you know, like 12 and 14. So I knew that I'd been doing this with my kids, and I felt like I could help other parents who aren't as comfortable with money and finances because of my background that I am. And I could see that it was, you know, that my kids were good with money and that they took it seriously. And that, you know, even at that time, it was paying off that I was having these conversations. So that's really what motivated it, just to help other parents who may not feel they know where to start or how to go about it.
Wow. Great. So our final question for you, Robin.
Yeah.
How do you define success in your life?
So yeah, I thought about this after I reviewed your questions for today. And I went thinking back to this program I did, which was the Coactive Coaching Training Program. And I did it about 15 years ago. And they had this tool that always stuck with me, which was the Wheel of Life. And the Wheel of Life was a circle that had 8 pie slices. And I'll tell you what those were in 1 second. So the idea is you sort of evaluate your life holistically. So it's not just one dimension, it's these 8 different dimensions. And I think you want to aim to be feeling fulfilled and have high levels of satisfaction in all those areas. So that's really how I would define success. And here they are. So personal growth, physical environment, work and career, money. So those are just 2 out of 8. Spouse and partner, family and friends, fun and recreation, and then lastly, health and fitness. And actually, I think I saw that there's other models where there's 10 pieces of pie, but I think these 8 like really resonated with me. So I try to keep that in mind. I try to aim for high satisfaction in all those areas. It's not always going to be, you know, what you want it to be, as long as you're working towards it. I think that's the main thing.
Wow. I like it. What a great answer.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
This has been a real treat, Robin. Thanks so much for joining us and for the work you've done. I think this has been a great, great conversation that many people will get a lot of value out of. So thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me and for asking such thoughtful questions.